When rock and roll crash-landed in the 1950s, it drew a line between old and new music. For centuries, music had been written for the live performance. But now, artists were writing to make records, augmented music that was often impossible to play. I'm Nick Mason. I play drums in Pink Floyd, and you're listening to A History of Music and Technology on the BBC World Service. This week, we're continuing the story of the recording studio and how the generation raised on rock and roll took popular music into new creative realms.
My musical upbringing was from my parents, who liked piano music, pub piano music, Russ Conway, Mrs. Mills, that type of stuff, and I hated it. Then suddenly rock and roll hit, my first love, Elvis. One through a party in the county jail. Then 12 and a half, Christmas, 1959. Got a tape recorder for Christmas. It was a Grundig TK-25 tape machine, and I fell in love with tape. I loved the smell of it. I loved the feel of it. I loved being able to edit it. So I'd have friends come over from school. We'd go to the local library and pull out books with radio scripts, and we would record radio plays. And that was it. I knew I had to work with tape somehow. And I eventually found out that the best position for doing that is to become something called a recording engineer.
Ken Scott grew up in the suburbs of southeast London and aged 16 decided that he'd had enough of school and went in search of his dream job.
A Friday evening, I pulled out a phone book, found as many places as I could that might need someone called a recording engineer, radio stations, recording studios, film companies, and I wrote letters to each of them, mailed them out on the Saturday, heard from EMI on the Tuesday. They wanted to interview me the next day, the Wednesday, so I crossed London for the first time on my own to my first job interview ever. And I guess I said the right things, because on the Friday I heard from them they wanted me to start the following Monday. So it took me 9 days to completely turn my life around and start on the most amazing career ever.
Today, Ken Scott is a renowned sound engineer and producer who got his start working in the tape library at EMI Studios, which belonged to the EMI record label. Better known today as Abbey Road Studios, they were for many years used to record large orchestras. But the rock and roll boom of the 50s and 60s took the studios into new territory.
As far as reputation of EMI at that point, people weren't particularly interested in recording studios, so most people had no idea what it was. It was the Beatles that started to make people aware of the recording studio, because they were turning recording into an art form.
The Beatles haven't a chance of leaving the airport just yet. In the VIP lounge, there's an army of press, newsreel, radio and TV interviewers waiting to ask them a question or two.
By 1963, the Beatles were the biggest band on the planet, and John, Paul, George and Ringo would revolutionise record making. Not just musically, but culturally too, transforming the corporate environment which characterised the major recording studios at the time.
The engineers had to wear suits and ties. Then there was the electronic whizzes. They had to wear white coats, white lab coats. And they wore them because they were coiling up mic cables that were filthy. They were working in the echo chambers, which were damp and nasty. And they also had to wear suits and ties. It was very, very businesslike. It was more business than it was art.
While it might seem surprising today, bands and singers had very little creative control over their music careers during the early 60s. Professor Andre Millard is an historian of popular culture at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and author of Beatlemania.
The recording studio was a company space, just like the factory. And so when you went in there, you went in there at a set time and you turned up and you were told what to play, and the engineer told you when and where and how to do it. Love me do. And you said thank you very much and you left, and the company then picked whatever recording they wanted to release, and that was that. It becomes a different place when the musicians that make popular music start generating the majority of profits for the company. Love me do.
The idea that a band should have a say in how their record should sound was a pipe dream for most artists. But by the mid-1960s, the Beatles were scoring number one hits all over the world and used their status to cross from the performer's side of the glass into the control room, where producers and engineers made the creative decisions.
You say you will love me. When I first started to work on actual sessions, it was for side two of A Hard Day's Night, and the artist could come up to the control room and have a playback of what they'd recorded, but it was still very much the producer, the engineer, and the act. There was a degree of separation between all of them. Norman Smith, the engineer for the first six albums, I think it was, up through Rubber Soul, he tried to make each album sound different. The very first one, he wanted it to be as live as possible in the studio kind of thing, and he would change as much as he could through each album, and I think the Beatles picked up on that, and they took the ball, and they ran fast with it. It wasn't just them coming up and listening to what was going on. They started to pass comment, oh, can we change the sound slightly, all of that. They started to really learn.
Another key collaborator for the Beatles was producer George Martin, sometimes known as the Fifth Beatle, such was his influence on the band's music. Professor Simon Zagorski-Thomas from the University of West London.
It's really important that George Martin came out of comedy records, novelty records, as his background. He recorded all the Goon Show albums for Parlophone. You know, he was a classically trained arranger, but he was also used to making weird noises on records. When the Beatles started to want to make weird noises, he was happy, and various members of the engineering team were interested in exploring what they could do.
Andre Millard.
With unlimited time, they could just start using the recording studio as basically a practice station. So they just turn up whenever they want and make the music in the studio. It's a wonderful example of how a cultural change in the studio can produce different kinds of music, different kind of art.
This unique position was put to good use, as the Beatles, George Martin, and the sound engineers at Abbey Road would go on to redefine pop music. Turn off your mind, relax
and float downstream. John loved mistakes and things to not necessarily be right. Take Tomorrow Never Knows. It was he went to George Martin and said, I want to sound as if I'm singing on the top of a hill or something like that. And so they started to put his voice for the last verse through a Leslie speaker. That was totally changing how a vocal had ever sounded before.
What made this unusual is that the Leslie speaker was more commonly associated with the Hammond organ, which you can hear more about in our previous programme about the Hammond. The Beatles used it to transform the vocals on Tomorrow Never Knows, a track featured on their 1966 album, Revolver.
This Leslie cabinet has a rotating speaker inside of it, kind of thing, and it gives this weird Doppler effect, the same as when an underground tube comes by. There's a change in pitch. You get the same kind of thing through the Leslie cabinet. And so they put his vocal through that and re-recorded it, and it gives a totally different sound and a totally unnatural vocal sound.
Revolver was a landmark for the Beatles, as not only did it mark the band's most overt use of studio technology to date, but it was at this time they also retired from performing live. A bold move for the biggest band on the planet, but it meant they could now solely focus on studio experimentation. Professor Simon Zagorski-Thomas.
Tracks like Rain, there really isn't a single sound on that record that was recorded at the speed that you hear it played back at. You know, the drums are recorded slightly slower and then sped up or the other way round, and there are all sorts of little bits of reverse tape things going on. There's all sorts of weird techniques that they were experimenting with. So their approach is much more about misusing the technology, thinking about what can I do with it that isn't in the manual?
It was during the making of the Revolver album that the Beatles advanced a recording technique which is widely used today. Double tracking is a process where you layer two similar vocals or instrumentals to give a richer, fuller sound. Of course, to do this, you have to record a performance twice.
One, two, three, four!
John hated to have to sing the song again, and he went to one of the electronic wizards, a gentleman by the name of Ken Townsend. He said, "Ken, why do I have to sing it twice? Why can't you just use the same vocal again? Put it on another track." Ken explained that, no, that doesn't work, because they had to be slightly different. It's an orchestra, a string section. The reason a bunch of violins sound big is because they're all slightly off time and slightly different pitch. If they were all exactly the same pitch and exactly the same time, even 12, 24 violins would sound like one violin. But Ken then went away and thought about how can we do it electronically.
What Ken Townsend came up with was automatic double tracking, or ADT, whereby a single performance could be recorded onto two tracks at once. Crucially, one track would have a slight delay, so when mixed together, the two tracks would create a type of choral effect.
John called it flanging. Well, we still have flanging today, and it's still called flanging, but it's done electronically now, not the way we used to do it. But this was an innovation that came from John pushing and us pushing back kind of thing, or Ken Townsend pushing back. And that's the kind of thing that happened with them.
But the Beatles were not alone. Over in the USA, another band was breaking new ground.
If everybody had a nose.
The Beach Boys made their breakthrough in 1962, and their surfer songs took the pop charts by storm.
Like California, yeah.
But like the Beatles, the Beach Boys also harboured a desire to break the rules. The band was signed to Capitol Records, which had its own cutting-edge studio in LA. But the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson craved greater creative control.
Brian Wilson wanted to get out of the big studios because the union system didn't allow him the control over the recording process. Basically, you weren't allowed to touch the mixing desk, or you weren't allowed to really have any control over the recording process if you weren't a member of the union and an employee of the company. So Brian Wilson started to use separate studios like Gold Star, the independent studios. And there were a lot of those in California at the time because of the film industry and the advertising industry.
A little slower. One, two, three.
One, two, one, two.
Music historian and producer Brian Kehew.
It is fascinating to see on the West Coast, out in California, the Beach Boys working on their records too. They remained largely tonal, working with notes and melodies in a very traditional way, even more elaborate than the Beatles as far as harmony, as far as vocal arrangements. But the Beach Boys were also into experimental ideas. Eventually they would create things like Good Vibrations, mixing electronic instruments with cellos, things that were not happening on a pop group on stage, but he was creating new sounds and wanted to have sounds that had not been mixed before.
The summer of 1966 saw the release of Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys and Revolver by the Beatles, two albums still revered today as among the greatest ever recorded, with both pushing the limits of studio technology at the time.
What Brian Wilson wanted to do was to experiment with performance and arrangement. He would choose strange instruments and put weird combinations together. And he is using multi-channel recording in order to be able to do that. On Pet Sounds, he was using 8-channel recording at a very early stage in 66, 67. The Ampex 8-channel machine that had been invented in 1958, they released a much better version in 66. He was using that for a lot of the Beach Boys recordings.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. Good vibrations by my...
Multi-track recording allows you to split up the individual ingredients of a song so you can mix them as you want in the studio. Invented in the 1950s, techniques advanced throughout the 60s. For example, the Beatles began their career recording on just two tracks and later three tracks. Even for the complex sounds of albums such as Revolver and Sgt. Pepper, they were still only using four-track machines. And then along came eight-track. And Beatles producer George Martin refused to use it. Brian Kehoe is author of Recording the Beatles.
The first eight tracks came in and they were deemed not fit for use by George Martin. We found the piece of paper where he actually wrote and said, we've been working in a certain style, we've been working with a certain kind of technique, and these eight-track machines will only do that with modification. We can't really do the recordings we've been doing, even though it offers us more tracks. We need to modify these machines first. And so began a long, slow process of modifying the machines for use.
One more time, not for that far back.
The Beatles finally got to use 8-track on 1968's The White Album, a hugely eclectic record musically speaking. It's an album which really exploited the potential of the recording studio when it came to composing songs, something that was necessary due to the fact that the Beatles, for some time, had been struggling to collaborate with each other.
They also started to build their own recording studios in the large homes that they bought themselves. And so basically you've got the Beatles commuting between their home studios and Abbey Road while carrying portable tape recorders. And so they're making music in little bits in different places and assembling them together. I think it gives you the impression of the Beatles as a band playing for you. In fact, because of the tensions within the group, these pieces of music are constructed from different isolated recording sessions with the wonder of four and eight track recording.
Despite the personal differences between the band, the White Album still had an abundance of experimental sounds.
There's a famous guitar sound on Revolution, the single by the Beatles, and it's a very fuzzy, almost nasty guitar sound, which is fantastically aggressive. And that was done by overloading the mixing desk and then running it through another channel to overload it more, that they could actually boost the signal in a way it was not intended, to overload the electronics that were not supposed to distort, pushing them into distortion. And in fact, it was not a sound that most people would really want, but it created a new guitar tone that the Beatles had not heard on anyone's record, and therefore it became appropriate. And there's such a trend of the year after. And the year after the Beatles do something, everyone's learned to do it, is copying them.
And there's one track in particular on the White Album which really exemplified the band's desire to push creative boundaries.
Number nine.
For the sound collage, Revolution Number Nine, John Lennon said he wanted to paint a picture of a revolution using sound. Dismissed by some critics at the time as pretentious codswallop, it was in part inspired by avant-garde composers such as Karlheinz Stockhausen, whose work we covered in our previous program on electronic music pioneers.
The fantastic thing about this Revolution Number 9 piece is that it is a purely experimental sonic structure. It's a sculpture of sound, if you will. They were learning from those largely European avant-garde composers. It really does exactly mimic what people were doing with experimental tape music since the 50s. And therefore, I think it's one of the most important pieces the Beatles ever did. They would distort things. They would get cacophonous. They would do experimental things. But this Revolution Number 9 really took the branch as far as it could go. And it still reached number one as a popular record that sold millions.
Throughout the 1960s, the Beatles and the Beach Boys raised the bar in terms of what pop music could be and redefined the musicians' relationship with the major recording studios. And for my band, Pink Floyd, which followed in their footsteps, to make Abbey Road our musical home, we're eternally grateful. And so were plenty of others. Simon Zagorski-Thomas.
During the mid to late 60s, it was very unusual for a band to be given as much leeway as the Beatles or the Beach Boys were given. As we get to the end of the 60s, because there have been these few iconic records, other people start, particularly artists. I mean, Jimi Hendrix is one who wants to experiment in the studio to the extent that he builds his own studio, Electric Ladyland, in New York. And you've got people like Frank Zappa, you've got Miles Davis with In a Silent Way, and particularly with Bitches Brew.
Miles Davis is one of the most influential musicians in the history of jazz. In 1970, he recorded the double album Bitches Brew, which employed innovative studio editing.
I mean, that's a really interesting record because it experiments in a way that very few rock records were experimenting, because it's about improvisation. He wanted to create a kind of collage of lots of different improvised performances, and he'd be saying, right, okay, you know, stop, let's do what we just did with changing the bass clarinet to the electric bass or something, you know, and he'd just be sort of directing. In fact, he used to give himself a credit on the album labels of Directions in Music by Miles Davis. And that was part of what he was saying, was that he was directing these performances that Tio Macero, the producer, had to splice together.
Another step change introduced by Bitches Brew was the way it was mixed using multi-track recording. Armed with the raw materials of the session recordings, Miles Davis left producer Tio Macero to his own devices to construct the album as he saw fit, cutting, splicing, adding effects and echoes, and ushering in the new age of post-production.
Tio Macero was taking over as the sort of creative mixer in those ways, and Miles Davis was encouraging him to do that. That record is really important because it marks the beginning of mixing as a separate process. I mean, the Beatles records, all of the effects and the processing was more or less done during the recording stage. But the idea of mixing as a separate creative process really only starts to turn up around this 1969-1970 period.
Coming up, we continue exploring the art of the mix as we delve into the origins of dub music and how autotune turned the music world upside down. That's on A History of Music and Technology with me, Nick Mason, coming up after the news. I'm Nick Mason from Pink Floyd. Welcome back to A History of Music and Technology on the BBC World Service. This week, we're continuing with the story of the recording studio. In the 1960s, bands like the Beatles and the Beach Boys took pop music to new heights. As the standard verse-chorus-verse songs, popularized in the 1950s, evolved into sonic soundscapes that took records into uncharted realms. Bands, producers, and sound engineers alike were learning how to stretch studio technology to its limit, which the industry responded to with even more powerful tools.
The 60s-70s transition is really enormous. And even in the space of 2 or 3 years, between 69 and 71, the landscape completely changed, almost from going to sort of 4, maybe 8-track recording up to 24-track recording, and all the associated expense. So on the one hand, your EMI studios at Abbey Road could afford all the latest technology. But that also meant that the slightly outdated technology was then finding new homes. They become affordable to a wider range of people.
And it was in Jamaica that a second-hand mixing desk was picked up by a sound engineer named Osborne Ruddock, better known as King Tubby, one of the pioneers of dub music. Sean Williams from The Open University.
Dub music is effectively taking a song and then reconstructing that or remixing it. And we're very familiar with the term remix now, but This was a completely new phenomenon, and it's something that really originated in Jamaica with people like King Tubby. It really stems from an economic question. For a long period of time, music was released on records, and a record has two sides. A single always had to have a B-side. To cut the costs, fairly early on, people like Tubby realised that actually, instead of recording a completely different song for the B-side, you could maybe just do a different version. Now, early on, it would be the same song, but maybe without the vocals. But what Tubby did was to radically reconstruct some of these original A-sides and completely reshape the original song into something that sounded completely different.
Tubby was a technical whiz and ran an electrical repair shop where he built amplifiers and serviced the equipment of reggae sound systems. He ran his own sound system too, Tubby's hometown Hi-Fi, which had a reputation for having the most exquisite sound. And in 1971, he opened his studio in the front room of his mother's house in the Waterhouse district of Kingston.
In the early 70s in Jamaica, the most common format for recording was probably the four-track tape, which allowed you to have bass, drums, maybe vocals and guitars, or some combination of those different elements. Now, Tubby would take the four-track tape, because he had a four-track machine, to really go to town on reshaping in real time. So using the faders on the mixing desk to just change the volume, often very rhythmically, particularly with the drum tracks. He might just drop some of the bass notes and only have a few of them by changing the position of the faders. He might use the reverb on the occasional drum beat to accentuate the space in particular times. Now, all of this was done as the tape was running, in real time, as a performance. And that really brings to the fore this sense of using the studio as an instrument.
There was a fierce rivalry between sound systems to find the hottest tracks to drop at dances, and King Tubby's remixes were in high demand. This meant there was always a queue of DJs wanting an exclusive for the weekend parties, which led Tubby to work at a phenomenal rate.
And because of the commercial pressure of having a whole lot of people asking for his services, he was really, really needed to develop a fast, effective practice. So he might listen once through and then get everything set and perform this mix in real time. So there's a real sense that although he's not performing on stage, it's absolutely a performance that's captured onto the record. The idea of remixing is absolutely fundamental to popular music production. These connections back to Tubby and the other Jamaican producers, it just can't be underestimated. There's so many terms that we use, you know, dropping the bass, all these sorts of things in record production now are so, so connected.
While perhaps not up to the speed of King Tubby, when you look back at some of the rock bands recording in the 1970s, they were often working at a furious pace too, my band Pink Floyd not included. After the Beatles broke up, Ken Scott went on to work with David Bowie, producing seminal albums such as Hunky Dory and Ziggy Stardust, both of which, remarkably, were put together in just a matter of weeks.
Recording contracts used to be the artist had to come up with an album every 6 months. And so you had to be quick, because the 6 month period is the recording of the album, it being released, touring, recording the next album. So everything had to be quick. And so like Hunky Dory and Ziggy were both about 2 weeks recording and then a week mixing. And David was such, of the four albums that I co-produced with him, 95% of the vocals that he did were first take, beginning to end. And what he did that one time through is what we're still here today.
Oh,
But as the 1970s rolled into the 80s, the recording process started to slow down, in part because of the increasing sophistication of the studio. Arthur Baker is a producer and remixer who came up in the disco era of the 1970s.
When I started in the studio, I did sessions on 8-track. 8-track would be 8 separate places to put music on the tape. But when I really started going into make disco records, by then it was 16-track, which was a lot of channels to put separate things. So on one track would be a bass, the other track, kick drum, snare, hi-hat, overheads. So you could split things out. So when it went to 24, it was like getting really serious, people thought. And then as the technology went further, you could have two 24-track machines sync together. So then you had 48 tracks, which sort of just breeds indecisiveness.
In the early days of multi-track recording, when you only had 2, 3, or 4 tracks to play with, you made mixing decisions as you went along, merging the parts you'd already recorded to free up a spare track. But with the advent of 48-track recording, it was possible to keep all the instruments on separate tracks throughout the recording, and add even more layers to a song too. And in the 1980s, records were selling by the bucket load, and labels were only too happy to advance bands' big recording budgets, which only encouraged them to spend even more time in the studio.
The only thing that would stop you is the economics. But when I was doing mixes for Fleetwood Mac, I had a big budget, so I didn't really care, you know. So basically, I started using studios that were expensive, studio engineers who were expensive, and I used cocaine, which was expensive. So literally, it was just got out of control. It just like I just spent like all this money because I could. I mean, because in reality, you don't need 10 tracks for the strings, but you could have the cellos on one track and the violas on another and the violins on the other. You know, what happened is that no one wanted to make the decision at the time anymore. You could get away with not making decisions till the last minute, and you'd make them when you do the mix. And then you'd have to make all the decisions at that one time.
But trying to mix so many separate tracks at one time was no mean feat and often required multiple hands if you were going to get it right.
Everyone would be on the board. You'd have an engineer, the assistant, you know, everyone in the group would be moving the faders to get the mix right. And so if you wanted something to go up during the mix, you'd do it and you'd have to do it manually. I was doing it live. I was doing it like a performance. So I'd bring the drums down and then bring them back in, creating the arrangement on the fly. And then we'd listen back and go, oh, this is where it screwed up. You need to take it from there. And then you'd cut it together.
But as computerized mixing consoles began to evolve, the mixing desk was able to take on some of these tasks, a process known as automation. Chris Lord-Alge is a mix engineer who's worked with bands such as Green Day and Muse.
Automation is a game changer. Okay, a console, at least the kind I use, has, say, 48 faders, okay? Each one of these faders has a different instrument on it, okay? When you mix music, you're moving these faders up and down. Well, guess what? Imagine if you could remember every single move you make and play it back, so it's the same every time. Once you get it right, you can save it. Well, that's called automation. Before automation, it was all manual, and you only have 2 hands, so with automation, you could be like you have 48 hands.
Parallel to the development of this increasingly sophisticated studio technology, a simpler and cheaper way of recording had also begun to emerge. While bands like Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones had set up studios in farmhouses and French chateaus, these very grand home studios were incredibly expensive. But that began to change with the development of portable tape recorders. Mark Mothersbaugh from the band Devo.
It was a Todd Rundgren album, and I was mildly interested in things he did. And he put out this album that had like 20-some songs on, but back in those days, LPs had a cover, and his was a gatefold, which I always loved because there was extra information and clues into what the artists were thinking and every little thing was important as far as I was concerned. I read every little line of type, and I saw this picture, and it was like a home snapshot, and there was cheap home carpeting, and then there was like one of those sliding doors that goes outside of a house. But there was this thing, and I'm looking, there's mic cables. Oh my God, he's got a tape recorder in a house.
A pioneer in home studio recording was the Japanese company, TIAC. During the 1970s and 80s, it produced a series of tape machines that would prove a revelation for bands on a budget. TIAC produced affordable four-track recorders, which were fundamental in the emergence of alternative rock bands like Devo, which were off the radar of the major record labels.
My brother ended up getting this TIAC machine right after that, and we just took off. I remember my poor girlfriend, I would tell her we're going to drink tea and eat crackers all weekend because I need $7.98 so that I can go buy a roll of Shamrock recording tape. I'd get a 7-inch reel, and that would have enough tape on it I could record two or three songs, new songs. And the first single that we released, Chaco Homo Mongoloid, that was our first record we ever put out from recordings on TIAC machines.
These portable machines were a remarkable development when only a couple of decades earlier, four-track recording was considered cutting edge. And yet now you could make multi-track recordings in your home. This heralded a new wave of independent labels and studios, serving bands which embraced the unpolished aesthetic that came from DIY recording. But in the music mainstream, this analog technology was being overtaken by the rise of digital recording, which presented a clearer, more defined sound. Chris Lord-Alge.
What's the downside to analog? It gets noisy. Okay, as you make copies, it gets noisier, it gets worse. It changes the sound, it adds something. Analog's like a tinted piece of glass, okay? Digital's clear, it just copies exactly what you have. But, you know, digital's not really a pretty medium. People, you know, love how records sound versus CDs. Well, you know, the thing about digital is what you put in is what you get out. So it's not gonna add to the sound, it's not gonna help the sound. Where analog kind of gave it some character.
Since the advent of sound recording, inventors had strived to develop a medium which could capture a truly realistic performance, something digital could finally deliver on. But when it eventually came around, it took some getting used to.
Now, I've heard a scientist say that the human brain treats a new idea the way the human body treats a new protein. Initially, it rejects it. That's new. I don't like it. I hate it.
Susan Rogers is a professor of music production at the Berklee College of Music in Boston and previously worked as Prince's sound engineer.
So the first time we analog engineers sat down with digital and we heard our stuff back, we thought, huh, what happened there? It did what it's supposed to do. It did exactly what you asked it to do. It was like visiting a different country. In this analog country, here's how things go. And now I've got my passport and I've gone to this digital country. Things don't go the way they used to go. And I have to learn how to do things in this country. And I have to add to my skill set.
But the digital revolution was to have a far-reaching impact on music production, helped by the rising popularity of home computers, which began to drop rapidly in price during the 1980s. Producer Ronnie Size.
Back in the day, there was like four computers. There was a Commodore 64, which is great. There was a VIC-20, there was BBC, and there was a Spectrum. It was a ZX81 first, and then it became the ZX Spectrum, 48K. And that changed my world. And we used to play games like Manic Miner, Jet Set Willy. We used to have all these games, and it was the 48K Spectrum, man. Remember, there was a program that came out, and you could like make these really sparse kind of beats. And then as soon as I kind of got over playing games, then I started to look at the Ataris. And it was like, oh, this is the real deal now. This is where you can really start to orchestrate your music.
The first Atari ST rolled off the production line in 1985, and it was ready-built for making music. Crucially, it came with MIDI capability, the common language through which electronic musical instruments and hardware can communicate. For under $1,000, the ST was a pretty sophisticated sequencer, where you could record and compose music with just a keyboard and a mouse. There was no need for an expensive mixing desk. It was hugely influential in the growth of electronic dance music in the 80s and 90s, kick-starting the careers of so-called bedroom producers all over the world, including drum and bass pioneer Ronnie Size.
There was nothing that could compare to the Atari ST-1040. It was the bomb. It got to a point where, you know, you had your sampler and you had your Atari, and that was it. You kind of just taught yourself how to use it. You spent hours in a room with the boop, 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 boop. Your girlfriend next door going crazy, like, turn that thing off. But you would spend days in that room just making beats and learning how to use the equipment and learning about EQing and compression and understanding about saving. Back in the day, we used to use floppy disks. Some people now wouldn't even know what a floppy disk is because there's not much on there, but that was all we had.
Today, this in-the-box production is how many people get their first introduction to making music. A laptop can match many studios in terms of production power, and software such as Logic, Ableton and Fruity Loops have helped further the democratization of the recording studio. Susan Rogers.
Often the records that sold the most were the ones that had the highest budgets. They could afford the best mixers, the best arrangers, the best producers, the best string sections, the best studios. It was hard to compete with that. In today's world, if you want to have a grand piano, it's right there in your software synth. You just call up that timbre and there it is. So anything that you hear in your head, you can affordably create.
This has been bad news for traditional recording studios, as demand for their services has dwindled, leading some to shut their doors. But what's mind-boggling for a musician like me, who started making music in the 1960s, is the seemingly limitless resources that comes with these digital workstations. While bands in the past found innovative ways to create music on limited multi-track machines, today a laptop can provide you with hundreds of tracks to record on. And you never have to worry about running out of tape. But this computerized means of production is arguably changing the way we interact with music too.
When you're working with digital audio tools today, you're looking at a screen. And that's risky because humans have more neurons devoted to visual processing than auditory processing. Vision is going to trump sound. So if you're looking at a screen, you're not hearing as deeply as you would be if you weren't looking at that screen. In the days of analog recording, because we couldn't see the waveform, we were focused 100% on the sound that was coming out of the speakers because there wasn't anything in the room we could look at that would tell us anything we needed to know. Today's engineers are at risk of making decisions about what they see rather than on what they hear.
And the digital workstation has also introduced a level of precision in music making that was previously never possible.
When I'm looking at a computer screen, the temptation then is to line everything up to a grid. Kick goes here, snare goes here. Kick goes here, snare goes here. And then to take that singer and line that singer up to the grid so that it sounds squeaky tight. But music is an expression of life, and life is not perfect. And things that happen in time don't have to be in time to the millisecond. There's some give and take there. Another risk is that our modern engineers, they can cut out little mistakes. And that could be at the detriment to the song. For example, if you've got a singer and that singer has just delivered a really powerful line in a song, the sexiest thing is if that singer delivers a powerful line and we hear that singer exhale. He or she has even more air in those lungs. That's a full can of whoop-ass. So these little things are important, and when we look at them on the screen, it's tempting to edit them out, pulling out the humanity from a recording.
Throughout the history of popular music, each generation has forged its own sound and musical identity. And while in the past we might have celebrated the imperfections in a performance, embracing mistakes even, it's arguably the pursuit of the perfect performance which has come to define modern music. And it's in part down to this man, an exploration geophysicist working in the oil industry.
My work was to research algorithms in processing seismic data to find oil.
And Andy Hildebrand was good at it too. Having built a company from scratch, he sold up and retired at 40 years old. Having returned to college to study classical composition, he then started a new venture combining his engineering skills with his love of music and began making software tools for the music industry.
At a trade show, myself and a few other people were having a luncheon and talking about what we might do as the next product. And the distributor's wife was there, and she said, "Well, why don't you make me something that would have me sing in tune?" I looked around at the table. Everybody was kind of looking down at their lunch plates. They looked very uninspired. So I thought, well, that actually is not a very good project, and no one's interested in it. So it sat on the table, if you will, for 9 months while I did something else. And then I had some free time, and I knew how to solve the problem. So I worked on it, and I took it back to that same trade show, and it was an instant hit. And it automatically tuned the voice in real time. So I called it Auto-Tune.
Auto-Tune launched in 1997 at the annual NAMM show in California, one of the biggest music technology trade shows in the world.
People loved it. The producers were ripping it out of my hands. And the reason was that a producer will spend a lot of time with a singer, having the singer sing parts over and over again to get them in tune. Well, with Auto-Tune, the singer sings it once and leaves the studio, and then the producer massages the vocal with Auto-Tune and makes it perfect. As a matter of fact, the software was widely used virtually in every professional recording studio, and it's about after a year that Cher did the Believe song.
While the music-buying public were unaware that Auto-Tune was being used to fine-tune vocal performances on the sly, Cher brought it to worldwide attention when her song, Believe, hit the number one spot in 23 countries in 1998. What was unique about the song was the way Auto-Tune had been used to distort her vocals rather than perfect them, creating an unnatural aesthetic which 20 years on has become a ubiquitous sound in popular music across the world. It's so sad that you're leaving. It takes
time to believe it. But after all, it's very widely used, not just in pop and rock and hip-hop. It's also widely used in country and western. I'm down here in Puerto Rico. It's widely used down here in all the Latin music. It's widely used in Bollywood. Almost everybody under 30 years old knows what Auto-Tune is. One more time, we're gonna celebrate. Oh yeah, all right, don't stop the dancing. But it's always kind of fun to see people's reactions when they say, "Oh, you really did that?" I had one person say, "Well, who did you work for?" "I didn't work for anybody. I worked in my home." "How many years did it take you to develop?" "Oh, about 3 months."
A distorted reality was the aspiration of the pioneering producers of the rock and roll era, and the digital age has made that easier than ever. Today, a studio can mean many things: a soundproof booth full of microphones, or a laptop, or a smartphone even. Studios such as Abbey Road still welcome the world's biggest bands through its doors, but technology has ensured that it's no longer the only way to forge a recording career. The barriers to entry have been lowered, and today a teenager working in their bedroom has an equal chance of becoming the next big hit maker. Next week, the future of music technology.
I am the proud possessor of a ticket to see Frank Zappa in a couple of months. He died about 30 years ago, but he's got a hologram.
But for now, thanks for listening to A History of Music and Technology with me, Nick Mason. The programme was produced by Richard Fenton-Smith and James Beard. The editor is Jasper Corbett. This programme was made in association with the Open University.